For the week of May 8th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 102, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, where I'm watching the Dallas Mavericks teach the Los Angeles Lakers how to play basketball, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in London, where I just watched the Yankees win another ball game, I'm Michael Giltz.
The Yankees aren't playing in London.
No, but I'm in London watching them online via the New York Times website.
Well, that's really nice.
Well, not video, but it was sort of a live recap as everything happened.
Ah, okay, I see. But now you're in London because you're there to see some really good theater, I would imagine.
Well, I'll do that when I get back from con, but I'm here stopping off on my way to the Cannes Film Festival. I come here, I reset my time clock, so I'm waking up at a normal time for Europe, and then I head over to Cannes.
Right, and that explains the audio quality, I guess, while you're traveling. But hopefully, in 2 days or 3 days' time, we will both be in the south of France attending the Cannes Film Festival.
Absolutely. Not hopefully, we will be.
Right. Well, I say hopefully because I still have an 18-hour journey to get there.
I believe you'll make it.
But we should figure out how we're going to cover the Cannes Film Festival, whether we do a 5-minute episode every day, just kind of briefing people on the day's events, or every other day. We'll have to figure it out once we're together in Cannes.
I don't think people would want a podcast every day.
Well, maybe if it's 5 minutes.
We can't even say hello in 5 minutes, so move it along.
Okay, well then on today's show, we won't be talking about Cannes so much, but we will be talking a lot about music news. One of the world's biggest record labels finally has a new owner. Amazon starts a price war over digital tracks. And how is the internet helping reinvent music videos? We'll tell you. The Tony nominations were announced last week for some of the year's biggest Broadway releases. We'll fill you in on who racked up the most nominations and why. Flixster and Rotten Tomatoes were sold to Warner Brothers. We'll talk about what such a move might mean to two of the internet's most popular movie websites. And on the eve of Cannes, an independent distributor goes bankrupt. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office worldwide this weekend was Fast Five, which grossed $119 million worldwide. And number two at the box office worldwide is Thor, which just opened in the U.S. It grossed $112 million. And number three worldwide is Rio, which grossed $24.4 million. And it's the first movie to cross $400 million worldwide in 2011. And number four is the Robert Pattinson drama Water for Elephants, which grossed $16.7 million worldwide and is at $64 million total. At number five is the romantic drama comedy Something Borrowed at $15.8 million in its opening weekend. In the U.S., you can find that number three is Jumping the Broom, a comedy which cost $13.7 million to make and only cost, I'm sorry, it grossed $13.7 million, basically doubling its budget. At number four, again, is Something Borrowed. At number five is Rio. Number six, Water for Elephants. At number seven is Tyler Perry's Madea's Big Happy Family, which is now at $46 million total. A little low for a Tyler Perry movie, actually. And number eight is Prom, the Disney comedy, which has just matched its budget of $8 million. And number nine, a successful indie film, Soul Surfer, which has grossed $36 million, doubling its budget. And at number 10, the flop, Hoodwinked 2, Hood vs. Evil, which has now grossed a total of $6.7 million.
On a $30 million budget, so it is a huge flop for the Weinsteins.
I wouldn't say it's a huge flop, but they knew it was a flop, and they dumped it in the spring to get it out there and get what little money it could. So they sort of maximized their profit and minimized their advertising costs by sort of dumping it. They made the right call. But if you look at our top 10, which I'm sure that was a little confusing, I don't know how I should do this. I really do think there's no reason not to talk about worldwide totals when they're available.
I know. But can we say that we're actually starting this trend? Because I noticed that you say, you know, worldwide first and then go to domestic, which I think is correct, because we do have, you know, a global audience. But then what's interesting is that Fast Five is number one worldwide this week, and Thor is number two worldwide this week, and it's the exact opposite here domestically in the United States.
Right, because Thor just opened in the U.S., so it's number one. It grossed $66 million, doubling the take of Fast Five. But around the world, they're sort of, you know, Fast Five has been out an extra weekend. So the fact that it stayed on top is kind of notable. It's grossed $325 million and Thor has grossed $242 million. So if you look at the top 10 in the U.S. and how they're doing around the world, you basically have seven hit films, two movies that are probably going to break even, and only one flop, Hoodwinked 2, Hood vs. Evil. So as the summer season is just really starting, that's an excellent record. Thor is a hit, Fast Five is a hit, Jumping the Broom is a domestic hit, Something Borrowed will probably break even, Rio is a massive worldwide hit, it costs $90 million to make, it's grossed over $400 million. Water for Elephants will probably break even. Medea's Big Happy Family grossed it's going to break even or make a little money. Prom is a break even movie at best. Soul Surfer a hit. So that's 9 out of 10 films breaking even or making good to great amount of money. You know, Thor launches a new franchise. Fast Five rejuvenates a franchise. Rio launches a franchise. This is great news for the box office.
Now, I would imagine you were traveling over the weekend, so you didn't get to see any movies like Thor.
I saw Thor at the press screening in New York, so I did see it. It was not good by any stretch of the imagination, but it wasn't awful. It wasn't embarrassing.
I thought, if I'm not mistaken, A.O. Scott of the New York Times said he wanted to throw himself under a bus midway through the movie.
Well, it's not good. There's no question about that, but it's not one of those horrible, hateful, oh my God, I can't believe I'm sitting through this pieces of junk. It's never really successful, but it somehow is not embarrassing. I have to credit Kenneth Branagh, I guess, and the lead actor, I think, has a certain personality. Again, I don't recommend it, but there you are. The funny thing is, you know, our image of the audience for a movie like Thor is, of course, geeky, pimply-faced, teenage male comic book readers, right?
I suppose.
Well, you're half right, because 63% of the audience for Thor was male.
But they didn't have pimples.
But that they didn't. You know why? Because 75% of the entire audience, male and female, was over 25.
So if they did have pimples, they had like adult acne.
But again, these blockbusters, these franchises, they're not geared to teenagers. We grew up with these movies, and now this is what we go see. So these movies are made for adults. The idea that they're just made for kids and kids power the box office is not always true. In fact, they're a little worried that kids didn't show up. Thor probably would have opened to 80 or 90 million if they had. But in fact, it's adults who are going to see these movies and making them commercial hits.
So you're saying Thor is an adult film. Hold on, I'm just going to write that down.
Don't say that. And then the one really big flop, I suppose, is The Beaver, the Jodie Foster film starring Mel Gibson, which opened pretty softly. It grossed $104,000. It wasn't on a lot of screens, but it did very poorly. It grossed under $5,000 per screen, which means there wasn't a lot of interest in it. It's probably not going to expand much, and it's probably basically done.
Well, you know, certainly I wonder if there will be a lot of interest in it next week in Cannes when it will premiere at least in Europe.
Well, right. I think it was a big mistake to accept the film and show it out of competition. It had already screened at South by Southwest. It had already been reviewed and covered by people, so there's no buzz excitement. And it wasn't critically acclaimed. You know, if it's a movie that gets a lot of critical acclaim, then I can see saying, all right, we want to showcase, you know, Blue Valentine, for example. Khan did that. That makes sense. It got a lot of attention. It got great reviews. The Beaver was, you know, mixed to poor reviews. So why they felt the need to jump on it, I'm not quite sure. And they're also showing Pirates of the Caribbean, and that just had its worldwide debut. So it feels like a little like leftovers for me.
Well, I know that one group that only wishes they had one of the top 10 films this year or this week is the film department. Just horrible news for them as Cannes begins. They were probably headed over there to sell some of their titles. The film department was started by Mark Gill, who was the chairman and CEO, and Neil Sacker, who was its vice chairman and chief operating officer. Now, Mark Gill headed up Warner Independent Pictures for the short time it was around and was the head of Miramax when the Weinsteins were still there. And he went off and he founded...
He would have been the head if they were still there.
Well, I mean, he was like the president of... He was their president.
They were the head.
They were the head. He was their, like, chief. Their
right-hand man.
Well, he was the head of their film group. So he was the chairman.
But he reported to them, surely.
Everybody reported to them.
Yeah.
He went off and started the film department, which is probably best known for financing and producing Law Abiding Citizen, which was a $40 million thriller starring Gerard Butler and Jamie Foxx. And it earned $133 million at the worldwide box office. And believe it or not, the company was making money. But somehow, based on the way they financed the company, all of their creditors kept knocking at their doors over the last 2 years, asking for their money back during the credit crunch. So despite the fact that they made $90 million, and I think in the past year, they made $105 million, it was going out the back door to all of their creditors. So as a matter of fact, Mark Gill told Deadline, "What if you made $90 million and your banks wouldn't let you keep any of it?" Basically, that's what happened to us.
Well, but I mean, this is the oldest story in business. You can have a restaurant and have customers in your seats, but if you don't have the right cash flow and the right business plan and the right financing, you're not going to survive.
So that's right.
I mean, and this is their best known movie. It's, you know, a kind of an anonymous action flick. Big deal.
Right. They have two other films, A Little Bit of Heaven, which is a love story starring Gael Garcia Bernal, Whoopi Goldberg, Kathy Bates, and Kate Hudson, as well as The Rebound starring Catherine Zeta-Jones and Justin Bartha. Two films which will now be looking for, I guess, another distributor to release them, because the film department is filing for bankruptcy. They did try and do an IPO, which was unsuccessful. They were never able to launch the IPO, and therefore they had to close their doors.
Yeah. Oh, well. I mean, it sounds like a small label shutters because they didn't have a good financial plan in place before they launched.
And they also ran into a little bit of bad luck with the economic downturn.
If you had a good financial plan, you wouldn't be in a position where you could have a hit film and still shutter.
A lot of these companies, the way they fund themselves and finance themselves, Relativity included, by the way, Relativity Films and Relativity Media, is they do it on debt and financed equity. And the way those are structured, you often structure them once and then you restructure them in the midst of it. But the problem for the film department is when they went around to restructure and raise more equity and raise more capital, unfortunately, the world had changed. They couldn't raise any more money, and they were being forced to pay senior creditors.
If they're smart, savvy guys, they'll land somewhere else.
And that's
the
exactly right.
Any good will show up somewhere.
Now, speaking of smart, savvy guys, the guys who started Rotten Tomatoes were some of the smartest tech guys around, and they eventually sold themselves to IGN, and IGN sold Rotten Tomatoes to Flixster, two of the more popular internet sites on, well, I was going to say on the World Wide Web, but who calls it that anymore? Now, both of those popular movie sites were sold to Warner Brothers last week, and now Warner Brothers Home Entertainment plans on running them. They're going to keep them independent, they say. Do you think that that's actually going to happen?
Well, it never happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's... this is a great way to kind of parse the press release. It's, you know, Warner Brothers Home Entertainment Group announced an agreement to acquire both Flixster and Rotten Tomatoes, and they have over 25 million worldwide users per month between the two of them. And now what they plan to do is use them to market their consumer application Digital Everywhere, which is a quote-unquote studio-agnostic application. I don't know how anything is studio agnostic. Every studio has their own technology that they're trying to push, but it's a technology which will be the ultimate destination for consumers to organize and access their entire digital library from anywhere on the device of their choice, as well as to share recommendations and discover new content.
Blah, blah, blah. What does Flixster do? I've never been on it.
It's basically a way for you as a moviegoer to rate and review movies to all of those friends who follow you. And you can see what the audience thought. Not what critics thought, but what do audiences think of a film?
How's that different from Rotten Tomatoes?
Rotten Tomatoes is what do the critics think of the film.
I thought it did audience people too.
It does, but they're doing that through Flixster now.
So if you want to talk about movies, you go on Flixster instead of like your blog or your Twitter or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, you can rate and review movies. You'll have your own little library of movies that you've seen and rated, and they can then compare that to what other people have liked, and therefore there's a recommendation engine behind it.
And how does that work with Digital Everywhere?
I have no idea, since, you know, I'm a little confused as to what Digital Everywhere really is. I guess it's a lot like TV.
Well, I think it's if you buy a movie or a TV show or an album, you should be able to listen to it on your, you know, consume it on your laptop or your PC or your TV or your iPad, iPad or your smartphone or your tablet or whatever it may be. So the idea is you can access your library anywhere you go.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Much like TV Anywhere. And I guess really what the studios are trying to do is cut out the middleman. They don't want to have to sell through Amazon or iTunes. They want to sell directly through themselves. That way they can keep the margin.
Oh, I didn't realize that was in place of iTunes or Amazon.
I have a feeling it is.
Oh, well, nobody wants to have to go to Warner Brothers to buy a Warner Brothers film. They don't want to have to go to eight studios to buy movies. That's crazy.
Well, I think that's why Digital Everywhere is supposed to be this platform where the eight studios come together and sell through one entity.
I thought it was just an ability to use the stuff you've purchased wherever you've purchased it.
I don't know. We'll have to get somebody on to explain it all to us.
All right. So this won't really affect anybody who uses Flixster or Rotten Tomatoes.
That's what they're saying. At least for now, it won't affect anybody who uses these two sites. But really, these two sites are really, they're about recommendation, whether it's from a critic or whether it's from a fellow moviegoer, they're all about recommendations. But the minute mm-hmm. that you align a site like that with an actual content distributor or content producer, you have to question
everything is owned by somebody these days, don't you think?
Yeah,
every newspaper, every magazine. I mean, Warner Brothers owns Entertainment Weekly. Do you question Entertainment Weekly as to whether they give a good or, you know, are nicer to Warner Brothers movies and TV shows? I don't think it matters. I don't think they care as long as you make money for them.
But right, you know, if GE bought Consumer Reports magazine, you'd somewhat question the reviews of dishwashers being...
No, I wouldn't. Like I said, it's just like Entertainment Weekly. If they end that, you know, if they end that freedom of that magazine, they destroy the magazine's franchise.
So you think if Harry Potter was an awful film, they would still pan it?
Of course, they don't have the time to worry about a review of Harry Potter in Entertainment Weekly. They can't be bothered.
Yeah, I wonder what happens the first time the head of Warner Brothers, the film division, logs onto Flixster and sees that all the fans are panning whatever their latest release is.
It happens all the time.
And meanwhile, you're collecting money through Flixster as a company, and they're panning one of your other products.
So what? It happens constantly. They look in Entertainment Weekly and see negative reviews of their stuff all the time.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, everybody owns newspapers and magazines and TV. They can't worry. It's just not worth their bother to try and get everybody to, you know, pretend to agree on stuff.
Well, you know, another group, speaking of Warner Brothers, Warner Music Group was sold last week for $1.3 billion, but then another $2 billion in debt. So really, it was a $3.3 billion purchase.
Wow. And so this was on the block for a while. There were a lot of people competing for it.
And there were a lot of people complaining that whoever was selling it, Goldman Sachs, was doing a really piss poor job and was completely incompetent. And so you had buyers pulling out of it.
What were they doing poorly? You have any idea?
You know, it was really just the way they set everything up and the way they were allowing the due diligence to be done. So you had buyers that were up in the bidding up until last week. And then they said, that's it. We're out.
Wow. Was any validity to the complaints, do you think?
Well, you know, when Warner Music Group asked me to bid, I said, yeah, I have no idea, really. But I do know that it was a 3-month auction, effectively, that included brothers Tom and Alec Gores and Sony ATV Music Publishing, among right. with a number of suitors. Ron Burkle, who now owns Miramax, was involved at one point. But in the end, it was Access Industries, which is run by, what is the name of his... Blavatnik. Yeah, Blavatnik. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I don't know.
Well, he's a billionaire who has shown an interest in a lot of U.S. entertainment assets lately. He bid for MGM
in
2000.
He's shown a lot of bad taste.
Yeah, he wanted to buy MGM in 2009. He purchased the UK division of Mel Gibson's production company, Icon Entertainment.
And yeah, that's not exactly a high-flying enterprise.
No, not at all. And now he is purchasing Warner Music Group. And there's talk that now that Warner Music Group has been sold, that Warner might go after EMI, which Citigroup has taken over because...
You're confusing the hell out of me. Come on.
Okay.
Too many companies. We don't care who the creditor is. Now that he's bought Warner Music Group, he might try and purchase EMI, which is based in London. So there are basically four major record companies. If he succeeds in purchasing EMI, there will be three left, three standing, and about a gazillion indie labels.
Correct. And they're saying, well, but the consolidation of four big record companies into three, that's going to have to meet regulatory approval.
They have their market share is so much lower now than it was before, and the market's shrinking so much, I don't think it matters.
Well, that very well could be. I just think it's very funny that they're like, but how could you go from four to three? And I think, well, you're allowing AT&T to suck up T-Mobile here in the United States, which is going from four to three wireless providers. So why wouldn't you do that in the record industry?
Well, but there's not three record labels. There will be three majors. And I think the share of the pie for indies is probably growing. It's got to be 10-20% now.
Yes, that's probably true.
I have no idea, but it's probably got to be up there. We should figure it out. But of course, you're getting less money for what you sell, aren't you, these days?
Yes, that's right. Now, I was just going to say, it's really all about the fact that the internet and digital music or digital sales have caused the record industry and the music industry to start decreasing their margins and lowering their profits. And now, of course, you have Amazon, who is launching a 69-cent MP3 store. So is this something you would actually... Would you go to this store and purchase a 69-cent MP3?
Well, this is not about record labels lowering their margins. This is about Amazon trying to bring in traffic to their site, compete with iTunes, and do it by selling music at a loss. It's the same thing that Best Buy and Circuit City and all those stores did when they sold albums for like $8 or $9 and drove the record stores out of business because they were selling CDs at a loss. Now, Amazon for a while was selling albums, digital albums, for $5, new releases, hot new releases. That was a loss every time they did it, but they drove people to their website. Now they're trying to do the same thing with a single. Sure, I'd do it. I'd buy a single for 69 cents. You know, on iTunes, you'll find hot new songs at $1.29. I'm not sure if this will be the hottest new songs or what songs they're going to be offering.
They're actually the hottest new songs, songs from Lady Gaga and Katy Perry.
Well, then it's a short-term money-losing venture.
But, you know, here's why they're doing this. This is my take on it. Think of the price here. It's 69 cents. You have the first 30 cents, the 30 cents they're giving up. Where would that have gone anyway? That would have gone to Amazon and 69 to 70 cents.
No, they're selling it for less than they paid for it. That's not true. Well, I mean, they're paying the record company like $1 or $1.10 to buy the single, to sell the single. When they were selling those albums for $5, they were paying $8 or $9 to have the right to sell it. So they're losing dollars and cents on every single they sell.
I would be...
No, that's exactly what they're doing. Trust me. The album sales at $5 was a lot. Every single album cost them more than $5 to buy. It's the same thing.
I'm not talking about the album sales. I'm talking about these 69 cents.
I'm saying it's the same thing. They're selling it at a loss, a pure loss. They have to pay the record label like $1, and they're selling it for 70 cents.
Well, when you go to Amazon or when you go to iTunes as an independent musician, and you really can't do it as an independent musician, but as an independent music label, they pay 70 cents on the dollar for every track that's sold. Here, they're paying 70 cents on the dollar for going their 30 cents because, frankly, care about it. They really want to sell these tracks so that people are putting them in the Amazon Cloud Drive and the Amazon Cloud Player because they want that to take off so that they have some ammunition with the record labels when the record labels inevitably come and try to shut down the Amazon Cloud Player so that all of these people...
I don't think this has anything to do with Cloud Player.
Oh, it absolutely does.
Why?
Because
I mean, they're trying to gain audience for their store
and their technology and their. I mean, they want people.
You don't need to use the cloud to buy it for 70 cents. I haven't used their cloud ever, and I probably never will. It doesn't drive me to their cloud.
Right, but if you've purchased something on Amazon through the Amazon MP3 store,
I see what you mean. You automatically subscribed to the cloud.
That's right. And that's what they're trying to do.
But again, they are. That's the same thing I'm saying. They're trying to build their audience for all their products and services. But they are, I assure you, they're losing money on every single. They're not just foregoing profit. They're actually sending money to the record label more than what they take in.
We have to get to the bottom of that.
That's absolutely true. I know they were selling it at a loss for $5. They were repeated stories in Billboard that they were having to pay like $9, $10 wholesale for the right to sell a digital album. That's what you do. You can't sell it for, you know, you have to pay them what, you know, if you want the right to sell it, you got to pay them a wholesale price. The wholesale price of a single is not 69 cents. It's a lot higher than that. They don't make 30, 40 cents off every single sold. They'd be thrilled.
I'm going to look into that. I will definitely look into that. And in a future episode, we will definitely try and cover that. But certainly.
And find out who's right.
Yes. And by the way, we should say, if any of our listeners know the answer to that question or any of the questions that come up in any of our episodes, please feel free to call us at 888-567-7263 or even email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. Either way, Amazon is really just looking to gain market share. Michael and I are kind of vehemently agreeing with each other in one aspect. Amazon only controls 10% of the digital music market, and iTunes has a whopping 70%.
That's right. I wonder where the other 20% is.
Probably Walmart or eMusic.
You're right. And so, of course, as we see, record labels shrink. Digital music is getting sold at cheaper and cheaper prices all the time. And, you know, there are fewer artists on big labels with big budgets. So, of course, when they're promoting themselves, they have their own website, they have indie labels, but they still like to do music videos, but they just have to be craftier and smarter about it.
Right. Actually, the reason you're bringing that up, Michael, is I highlighted for us to speak about this week an article in the Wall Street Journal called Beyond Thriller, Reinventing the Music Video. And this is something I have kind of noticed over the last year or two, is that the music video has been reborn. And Michael Stipe said that, you know, MTV made the music video in the 1980s. And the lead singer of REM said, now YouTube has brought the music video back. And of course, we talked I think it was last week or the episode before that, episode 100, where we talked about Vivo moving over to the UK, which is, I guess, four of the record companies have gotten together and created a music video website called Vivo and taken control of the videos that they put out, but they're all much cheaper now. They're not spending $2 million to make a music video the way Michael Jackson used to do.
Of course not, because you've got flip videos with high definition. You can make, you know, if you've got a little talent and creativity, you can make a video for an incredibly inexpensive amount of money. We talk about amateurs making videos and having hits on online. And of course, artists who used to make videos and have them shown on MTV just to sort of promote the album, now they can make videos cheaply and they can actually make some money off of it. When they get 5 million, 10 million hits, like people like Lady Gaga will, they actually get, you know, serious size checks from places like Vivo and YouTube.
Yeah, well, they're saying on Vivo, a label whose videos rack up 10 million streams of a single video could collect around $70,000 US. And of course, that's how much they're paying to actually make the video. So they're not only breaking even on these music videos, but of course they're promoting the music itself.
That's right. I mean, a lot of people now, when they want to listen to music, they're not going to MySpace anymore. But if they're interested in an artist, they'll go to YouTube or Vivo, type in a name, and start to watch videos. Sort of, you know, on-demand radio.
Right. And what this article in the Wall Street Journal is pointing out is that Chris Milk, and I guess is the pioneer in this area, he is trying to find a way to allow viewers to engage in the music video more than just being a casual viewer or, I don't know what the right word would be.
Who is Chris Milk?
He is a commercial and music video director. He's also the guy behind the Creators Project, which is the art group or, I don't know what you'd call, it's an art project. And it's a group that did the whole Arcade Fire big giant beach balls at Coachella, the light up beach balls at Coachella.
Uh-huh.
When the Arcade Fire was on stage, they do...
It's like an artist collective.
Yes, thank you. I could not think of the proper category or label to throw
right.
on them.
The nice thing is when you see a new form come about like music video, you had a lot of people who did commercials and other stuff or just launched into music videos and show a lot of innovation and talent and creativity. And now that it's sort of stopped being so stultified and so expensive, and you've got people who are sort of set free again because they're cheap and they're just working for themselves or their indie label, they're showing a lot of creativity. The one that Chris Milk did for Arcade Fire called Ain't No Grave?
No, actually, that was the one he did for Johnny Cash. That was the name of the song. And what he did was he got together with Google. Now, the Creators Project is actually funded by Intel, but this particular project, Ain't No Grave, he got together with Google and got all of this old footage and is allowing users to animate frame by frame this Johnny Cash video. And it's just very eerie and interesting. And it's an unreleased track by Johnny Cash. And it's kind of a crowdsourced music video for Johnny Cash.
Oh, that's right. And the Arcade Fire song was We Used to Wait, where if you watch the video, you can type in where you're from and suddenly they take you via Google Maps and all this stuff to like your hometown.
It was a fascinating project. All of these web browser windows would pop open and all of a sudden there was your house and there were pictures from your hometown in sepia tone, and it was a nostalgic view while you were watching this music video. It was fascinating.
And we talked about in the past about kind of fun videos by OK Go and MGMT and other people. So videos are sort of back creatively.
Well, right. I mean, MTV used to be such a big outlet for musicians in the 80s and early 90s because that is where you could get, instead of radio play, you could get a lot of, you can gain a lot of fans and presence by having a hit music video on MTV. Well, now,
right. Airplay engendered radio play.
Right, exactly. And now it's YouTube play. I mean, Lady Gaga's new single, Judas, leaked to the web last Thursday. And I think I just checked before we started taping. The video already has 10 million views on YouTube.
Well, sure. She's probably the biggest act in the world at the moment, right?
Probably. If not the biggest, certainly one of the biggest. And without a doubt, it just shows you the power and the reach of the internet.
Well, yeah, but that's four teenage girls watching it 1,000 times each. It adds up.
That's not true. It was 5 teenage girls.
But speaking of MTV, their top executive just stepped down. Judy McGrath, who was the chairwoman of the sprawling MTV Networks group, left the company after about 3 decades.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't necessarily surprised by this. Everybody thought she was going to get booted in 2006 when Sumner Redstone kicked the architect of MTV, Tom Freston, out.
That's right. But she remained and has, you know, been at the helm for 5 years, and now she's stepping down. She says, of course, it's her own decision, but it sounds like she's been pushed out by the more straight-laced people in charge at Viacom.
Right. Well, and it very well may have been her own choice and not her own choice.
Been around for 30 years.
Right. Yeah. It's, in other words, she may be saying, you know what, enough is enough. I didn't really want to stay after Freston was moved out. I stuck around, I stayed, and now I can't take it anymore. I'm out of here. Because, you know, Viacom chief executive Philip Doman, or is it Doman? He will be more hands-on. They're not going to replace her. And instead, all of the different cable networks that Viacom controls will all report into him instead of reporting up through her.
But she's certainly leaving out on top. She was overseeing MTV and Nickelodeon and Comedy Central. And, of course, she's been, you know, overseeing everything from The Real World back in the 80s to, you know, Jersey Shore, SpongeBob SquarePants, South Park, The Daily Show. I mean, she's got a huge, you know, a list of accomplishments to look back on.
Right, because it wasn't just MTV. It was Nickelodeon and Comedy Central, as you're pointing out.
I just said that.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Did you say, did you mention Nickelodeon?
Yeah.
And did you mention Comedy Central?
Yeah.
Or did you just mention shows that were on Nickelodeon and Comedy
Central? I said Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, then I named the shows.
Then you know what I think we should do?
What?
Move on to Oprah.
See, now this is a negative example in my mind. I don't know what you think about this, but the Oprah launched the Oprah Winfrey Network, or OWN, about 4 months ago, I guess, and they've already fired their top executive.
Well, this is a network that has been going through management shakeup and turmoil since it launched in conception, before it ever actually hit the airwaves last spring. You know, Christina Norman was selected as the CEO last spring. The then president resigned. And now Christina Norman has been pushed out as CEO, and the chief operating officer of the OWN network, Peter Liguori, is taking over as an interim CEO while they look for a new CEO.
But, you know, this is ridiculous. This channel launched 4 months ago. Oprah Winfrey hasn't even left her daytime show yet. She hasn't even really joined the channel, and she's obviously the number one draw. So they're rejecting someone before the show's even begun. The channel has not even gotten on its feet. There's no way you can judge the work she's done at this stage.
Right. I like what Peter Liguori had to say. He said, "We have learned a lot in 4 months, but now is the time to learn where the network is going to go." Really? Maybe you should have done that before January 1st, before you launched. He says, "There's a need for a fresh perspective, which allows everyone to do their best work." A fresh perspective? How old could the old perspective have been? It's only 4 months old.
Exactly. Now, maybe, of course, she was just doing a terrible job, blah, blah, blah. But my guess is that they just panicked over the low ratings and decided to fire the top people. But you see this in TV a lot. Someone gets hired for a network. They have to shepherd through the last guy's choices for new television shows, because it takes like a year to get your own shows in the pipeline. So you get hired, you oversee the previous guy's shows, and some of them win and some of them flop. And then you start to pick your shows, and before they can launch, they fire you. So you oversee the last guy's stuff, and before you can oversee your own stuff, you get ousted in a year and a half, 2 years. And so nobody has any idea of what kind of job you might have done. 4 months, either they made a disastrous choice, or more likely, they just panicked over the ratings and never gave her a chance to do her job.
You've hit the nail on the head. Number one, the same is true with studio heads. Usually the new studio head is getting applauded and congratulated for all the films that come out within the first 6 months of their reign, when really those films were the last person's projects. Really, this is all about the OWN's or OWN's poor ratings.
Yeah, and nothing. This channel does not exist until Oprah joins it and does some live primetime specials.
Which she's going to be doing at the end of this month, the end of May. Her contract is up with her OWN talk show after 23, 25 years, and she will be focusing all of her attentions on the cable network.
And I'm going to be focusing my attentions on the Tony Awards pretty soon.
That's right. I know you were disappointed last week when we recorded on Monday, one day before the Tony nominations were announced, because it means we would be talking about them about a week later.
That's right. I mean, I've never been more informed about the Tony Awards. You know, usually with the Oscars, I've seen every movie practically that's nominated, if not every single one in every category. The Tony Awards, I've rarely been able to see all the shows. This year, I am so on top of it. I've seen everything, literally, that's been nominated except for one show.
What show
do you think that is? Guess. Take a guess.
Book of Mormon.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's
the
you
one
know,
show that has the most nominations, 14, a near record. The record is actually 15 held by the producers and one other show. Lordy, I'm forgetting. But it received 14 nominations, basically everything it was up for. And it's the hit show of the season. I can't wait to see it. I think I'm going to see it the week I get back from Cannes. Cross your fingers. But I've seen everything else, so I feel more in tune with the Tony Awards and more on top of it than I ever had before. So I'm very excited.
Well, yeah, it was nominated for Best Musical, Best Book of a Musical, Best Original Score, Best Direction, Best Choreography, Orchestrations,
everything.
Scenic Design,
everything.
Costume Design, Lighting Design, and Sound Design, as well as for leading actors Josh Gad and Andrew Reynolds. Featured actor Rory O'Malley, plus best crossover from an animated television show on the Comedy Network.
That's not a real category.
Yeah. So, I mean, pretty amazing. Now, it's up against, you know, for best musical, Catch Me If You Can, The Scottsboro Boys, which I know you liked, Michael, and Sister Act.
I love The Scottsboro Boys. It opened in the fall. It closed after about 2 months, but it was one of the final works of Candor and Ebb, legends in Broadway, who of course did Cabaret in Chicago, which is still running, by the way. And it was an amazingly good show. I was so disappointed it closed early. And sometimes, you know, they forget a show if it's closed that quickly, and it was, you know, last fall. But they really remembered Scottsboro Boys. It got 12 nominations, all extremely well-deserved. I'm hoping this will give it an impetus to come back because it's a very inexpensive show to mount in a way. So if the cast is available, they had spoken last fall about bringing it back in the spring. I'm hoping that can still happen. I guess not, since we haven't heard anything about it yet. But it's great for the show. It absolutely deserves it. It's extremely well reviewed. I'm the only person who liked Catch Me If You Can, which got dissed in a lot of categories, but did make it into Best Musical. So I was a little disappointed for that show. I think it deserved more, including its lead, Aaron Tveit. But he didn't make it into the best actor category for musicals because it was an incredibly good year for actors in musicals. Neither did Daniel Radcliffe, who starred in the revival How to Succeed in Business. That show is up for best revival. It won a ton of nominations, but not Daniel Radcliffe. And everybody said, oh, they're dissing him. They're dissing him. You know, he's a Hollywood actor and, you know, they're just sticking with their own. Number one, there were four other people who were definitely going to get nominated. Two guys from Book of Mormon, Norbert Leo Butts from Catch Me If You Can, and the lead of the Scottsboro Boys. So there was one slot left, and you had Daniel Radcliffe from How to Succeed in Business, Aaron Tveit, who's a big star on the rise for Catch Me If You Can, and one of the leads in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is also doing extremely well. So those three guys are fighting for one slot. The guy from Priscilla got it, but you know, it's not a diss on Daniel or Aaron Tveit, I don't think.
Well, over in the Best Play category, you had Good People, Jez Butterworth's Jerusalem, Stephen Adley Gurgis, is that how you pronounce his name?
I think so.
The Mother Effer with the Hat, and Nick Stafford's War Horse.
Yeah, War Horse is a big show that came from London. It got good reviews and is a huge commercial hit in the UK, and looks like it's going to build into a really big hit here. Good People was very well reviewed. Jerusalem was raved over and stars Mark Rylance, who's probably the greatest stage actor alive at the moment. And The Mother Effer with the Hat is doing very well, too. That co-stars Chris Rock. So there are four good plays. I would go for any of them other than Good People.
I would imagine that Al Pacino is going to collect an award for Merchant of Venice.
Well, actually, lead actor in a play is the single toughest category imaginable. It's an incredibly tight category. Brian Bedford starred and directed The Importance of Being Earnest and got rave reviews. He was very, very funny. Bobby Cannavale, is that how you say his name?
Sure,
why not? In the Mother Effer with the Hat is a guy who's really committed to Broadway, but he's also got this sexiness of starring in movies, and he gives a terrific performance in that show. He carries that show. Joe Mantello in The Normal Heart, he is a beloved Broadway fixture. He appeared in The Angels in America when he won the Tony for actor, and then he's gone on to have an incredible directing career. This is his first performance since Angels in America, and it's a revival of another searing AIDS play, The Normal Heart by Larry Kramer, and he's such a beloved fixture, and he's back on stage for the first time in like 16 or 17 years. It's an event in and of itself, and he's also terrifically good. Then there's Al Pacino in The Merchant of Venice, which was the best production of that show I've ever seen, and then Mark Rylance, who literally is one of the best actors alive in the world, and he just won the Tony a year or two ago for Boeing. So this category is impossible to pick. I have no idea. My guess, gut instinct, is maybe Joe Mantello, because they love him.
I can tell you who's not going to win any Tonys this year.
Who's that?
The folks behind Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, won't win anything because they haven't even opened yet.
That's right. They'll be eligible for 2012.
Right, and they are just now going back into rehearsal with guess who?
Who?
Christopher Tierney, the actor who fell 30 feet from a platform and nearly died. He's back, out of the hospital and reprising the stunt role of Spider-Man. I don't think he plays the lead character, but does a lot of the stunts and the flying.
Yeah, he's one of the several guys. I don't believe his life was ever threatened, but thank God he was not, you know, paralyzed or injured long term. And it's great to see him back on the stage.
Well, I know that when he did, you know, he fell two stories that, you know, people thought it was a big deal.
That's right. It was a big deal.
Ugh, you didn't bite there. I was trying to transition into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story this week is about Jerry Seinfeld. By the way, can I just say how smoothly we just transitioned there? I know I'm not supposed to call that out, but still.
Nah, you're doing it.
Anyway, Jerry Seinfeld just launched his new website, unsurprisingly called jerryseinfeld.com. But Jerry doesn't want to fatten you up with an overload of the thousands of clips he's culled from decades of doing stand-up shows and TV interviews. So every day you can visit the site and watch three clips Jerry has curated for you. Come back the next day and you'll find three more. One might be a comic aside done on Letterman, the next from a stand-up show in the 80s, the next from his current tour. You get the idea. Comedy, but not so much of it that it makes you sick with laughter. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's it's a big deal. Johnny Carson's website is doing a similar thing, but it's only accessible to people in the industry, which is really a shame. And I think a lot of these artists who see, I've got a ton of material, how do I present it to the world? This is a clever, good way to do it. You keep it fresh every day, but you use all that material you have. Why let it sit fallow? It's not the sort of stuff that you can, you know, sell a ton of. But if you let people see clips of it, yeah, you can market best of clips and things like that. It's just a great way of using all that material you have. I try to do the same thing with my articles and transcripts, and you know, it's just a smart thing to do.
Right. It's a way of monetizing it yourself.
Well, I don't know if he's monetizing. I don't know if the idea is to make a lot of money off ads. I think it's just a smart way to keep your presence alive online, keep your memory fresh with people. And when you do sell those compilation videos and DVDs, it lets people know, you know, oh, I love Jerry Seinfeld. I'd love to get that. Or I want to buy season 1 through 7 of Seinfeld or whatever. Just keeps you in the audience eye.
First, Will Smith agreed to star in the next M. Night Shyamalan movie. Now Quentin Tarantino wants Smith to take the lead in his spaghetti western / Unchained slave epic, with Smith starring in Django Unchained, playing a black man unleashed on the racist southern world of plantations in the 1800s. Is Will Smith the biggest star in Hollywood? Can Tarantino pull off a film about a touchy subject such as slavery the same way he did with Inglourious Basterds, a film about Nazis? And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Will Smith is, I think, the biggest star in Hollywood. He's incredibly bankable. Tarantino can pull off a spaghetti western set in the slave plantation world. I think that's a great idea, especially since Will Smith will presumably be killing racists. And it's not nearly a touchy subject, I don't think, watching a guy kill racists. And Inglourious Basterds wasn't touchy. A movie about Nazis being shot and killed is also not touchy. And is it a big deal? Not really, but it's a fun bit of casting news.
I like the way that Tarantino is not calling it a western. He's calling it a southern.
That's right. That's funny.
If a comic book label like Marvel can hire someone to serve as a liaison between them and Hollywood long before they launch their own studio, then surely it makes sense for a video game company to do the exact same thing. That's the thinking that convinced Ubisoft that people involved with Assassin's Creed and Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell, to name just two, to hire Jean-Julien Baronet to oversee their TV and film properties. Now, who's the agent for Angry Birds? But before you answer that, Michael, tell me if this is a big deal or a big whoop.
Well, I think it's a big deal as a sign of the times. Every, you know, major video game company should have someone like that, someone to help them navigate Hollywood and make sure they're doing deals with quality people that will make the most of their product. I personally would love to see a film based on Assassin's Creed.
It's official. Moments before we recorded this podcast, Paula Abdul finished her down-to-the-wire negotiations and signed on to Simon Cowell's The X Factor. She may play a dizzy babe on TV. Dizzy or is it ditzy? Who knows? Well, she's hard as nails when it comes to money and ready to get the payday she deserves after Idol kept dissing her. Also announced were not one, but two hosts, just like the original Pop Idol and, of course, American Idol during its first season. They are male model Steve Jones, who's a rising star on UK TV as a presenter, and a former Pussycat Doll singer, Nicole Scherzinger?
I guess.
Are all these announcements a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I mean, American Idol is still the number one show in the country, and yet we're anticipating the show like it's the second company. They're getting so much attention. It's amazing. Paula Abdul is a great choice. They were pretty tense negotiations. I'm glad they were able to sign the deal. Nicole Scherzinger, she was in Pussycat Dolls. I mean, this is a woman who knows how to land on her feet. Talk about a pussycat. She was in that, you know, sort of fake supergroup. Then she won the 10th season of Dancing with the Stars. She also appeared on the Sing-Off, which was NBC's a cappella show choir competition show with Nick Lachey as a host. She was one of the judges. Then she went to the UK and was sort of dissed by one of the women who's going to be on the American version of The X Factor, Cheryl Cole, who said, I don't think much of Nicole. But then when Cheryl got sick, Nicole replaced her and did a great job. Everybody loved her. That was sort of her audition for this. So she's just going from, you know, bigger to bigger to bigger every project. And Steve Jones is very good looking.
That's probably when that's all you can say about the guy, that says something.
No, more power to him. I can't wait to see what he's like.
Fans waited decades for author Stephen King to finish his epic Dark Tower series. Now they may have to wait years more for the series to come to life on TV and film. Director Ron Howard has a remarkably ambitious plan to film 3 movies and intersperse them with 2 TV miniseries to do the entire tale justice. The project has just been put on hold by Universal, which started to blanch at the Lord of the Rings-type roll of the dice they were making. Now everyone is waiting to see if the tale starring Javier Bardem will get a green light in some new form everyone can agree on. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal because it's such a big project. It really is dauntingly ambitious. It's a fascinating thing for Ron Howard to be tackling. More power to him. I'm not sure how all the pieces come together and whether this works. Clearly, The Dark Tower is, you know, Stephen King has a big fan base, but it's not remotely the same fan base as, say, The Chronicles of Narnia or The Lord of the Rings. So it is a huge, huge gamble, much more so than those other movies were. You know, this is a relatively lesser known product that Stephen King has put out over the years. It's a 7-volume series. There may even be an 8th. And I would hesitate and want to make sure I had everything right and make sure that it was the right type of project that would have that big broad appeal, because it's a weird, quirky series. So, you know, I hope they make it happen in the way that they want it to so that it works. Maybe it should just be, a 7-season series like Game of Thrones may be on HBO. I don't know. Maybe a movie isn't, movie/TV thing isn't the right way to go.
It's a big deal for me because this is the way movies and television shows, they get put into turnaround hell. They start off with these big ambitions, then they say, well, we're just going to take a beat here and rethink it just a bit to get the budget under control, which means we're never going to touch it again.
Which means we don't want to spend $400 million on this property.
Right. However, they do actually wind up spending $400 million on such films. If it succeeds, everybody wants to take credit for being the executive that said, I was the one who said we should really go for it on this one.
Well, you ask Ron Howard, he'll tell you he was the one that actually made it happen.
That's true. Speaking of making things happen, Amazon has been selling the Kindle e-reader hand over fist, but the recently discounted device, which is down to $118 for some versions, it just doesn't have the profit margins that Apple enjoys with the iPad. Rather than try and turn the dedicated Kindle into something it's not, Amazon is also about to launch a tablet to compete with the iPad on its own terms. Orders have reportedly been placed, and the tablet should launch this fall. No word yet on specs or on pricing. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. The tablet market is exploding. iPad dominates it. Nobody else has been able to get a foot in the door yet. I think Amazon's really well positioned for that. I think they're smart not to mess with the Kindle and try and turn it into some sort of hybrid thing, make an entirely new device that does well what a tablet can do. And I think maybe they're also realizing it's kind of sexy and fun to sell your own stuff rather than get a couple pennies extra for selling somebody else's book.
Right. Especially now that, you know, all of these computer commodity parts, they're just so cheap, you can put it together yourself.
Well, right, but doing it well and right is hard.
Well, that is very true. Spotify launches its own music store a la iTunes, speaking of getting things done well and right. Along with the ability to sync with your iPod and an app so you can access Spotify playlists on your iPhone or Android smartphone, the more songs you buy at a time, the cheaper they are. That's just one wrinkle Spotify hopes can lure people away from iTunes. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop in the sense that it's what you have to do if you want to compete. You can't exist without, being able to be a full-service product for people. If you want to be Spotify and compete with iTunes, you're going to have a store, you're going to have to be on phones, you're going to have to be in the cloud, you're going to have to do everything. And you certainly want to be compatible with people's iPods.
Right, and I have a feeling that this was Spotify's way of saying to all of these labels that they're now currently trying to negotiate licensing deals with so they can move over into North America, hey, you know what? We'll launch something that will put us on par as a competitor to iTunes, which is something you're looking for.
Exactly.
Right. Now, that does bring us to Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the news stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. This week, we're going to return to the subject of music and talk about concert ticket prices and how, well, what the industry is doing about them. Because as you know, Michael, last year was not a very good year for concerts.
That's right. I mean, the recession meant that people had to be careful with their dollar, and forking out $100, $200 to go see one show just didn't seem like a good idea. That's why festivals have become more and more popular.
Right. I mean, last year, concert tickets, the gross receipts fell 7.6%. And there were acts like the Jonas Brothers and Lilith Fair that canceled shows. In fact, the Los Angeles Times is reporting the Greek Theater here in Los Angeles, they canceled 9 shows, which is kind of a record for them.
Wow, because there probably isn't more than one show a weekend or something like that. So that's a lot.
Yes.
You know, some act would come and they'd have 2 or 3, you know, days in a row. So to cancel 9 engagements is a lot.
Right. And Mark Campana, the president of Live Nation Entertainment Inc.'s North American concert business, said, "What happened last year was a wake-up call. What we realized was that you can't just wish a show home now the way you could before. You really have to work at it." And he was talking to the Los Angeles Times when he said that.
Right. So what they've done in response is to say, duh, we need to have lower ticket prices. We need to lower all the add-on prices we add on to the tickets, all the little surcharges, and we need to package acts more. You know, people want to go to festivals, or they want to see something like the current tour with New Kids on the Block and the Backstreet Boys. You know, you put those two groups together, suddenly that seems like a much more attractive show. You put Sade with John Legend. All right, it's not Sade with some little actor you've never heard of. It's Sade with John Legend, who could tour on his own. And together, they start to seem like a really good value.
Right. That's really what they're doing, is instead of taking an A-list act and then putting them with a B and a C-list act, they're taking an A-list act and putting them together with an A-list act to give the tour more bang for the buck.
Right. And let's not be too upset for the concert industry, because as record sales dropped, concerts became more and more valuable. People said the one thing they can't download digitally is the live performance. And so people were really forking out a lot of money. And really, the concert business had 14 years of uninterrupted growth. So yes, we're having a correction now, but you know, come on, relax. You know, you can't have 100 years of uninterrupted growth. If you have 14 years in a row, you have to be prepared for some pullback. And that's when we can have a correction in price. So in fact, I think this is not so inside baseball, because it really affects anybody who loves music and wants to go to a concert. It's good news that they're sort of waking up and saying, yeah, we got to start, you know, treating fans better.
Right. And as you mentioned, 14 years of uninterrupted growth right up to 2009, when gross receipts peaked at $4.6 billion. And that is compared to, in 1995, $950 million for gross receipts to concerts. And this is all according to Pollstar. Now,
right, that's more than 4.5 times bigger.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, but
huge,
then look
huge
at
growth.
Right. Look at the difference between $26.81 as the average ticket price in 1996, and in 2008, the average ticket price was $67.33.
Yeah. So I love acts like Garth Brooks, who always kept their prices really low, and it's a great way to keep fan loyalty.
Right. I mean, Bruce Springsteen in 1999, I paid $95 to see him. When I saw him in 2008, I paid $95 to see him. So 10 years time and not an ounce of inflation.
And how much do you pay for your satellite radio system?
I don't even want to talk about this. I mean, this is just really upsetting to me. I have been an XM radio subscriber for, I don't know, 5 years now. And it's always been about $12.95. They merge with Sirius Radio. So the two satellite groups merged. Mel Karmazin becomes their CEO. And for 3 years, he's told, you can't raise prices. So instead, what he does is he goes out and he says, okay, we're going to charge for internet streaming. Okay, maybe you need to do that to cover bandwidth. Fine. But now he's told, I guess, a group of analysts during a quarterly earnings report call that he's actually at the end of, or at some point in 2011, he's going to start raising prices.
You knew this day would come.
Yes, but I mean, really, you're going to start raising prices? As it is, I'm wondering whether I need this already.
Well, what would you do in your car then? Would you have to buy a whole new radio?
No, I'd plug in my phone and listen to Pandora, or I'd listen to RDO or radio, whatever they
call it. But you won't get Howard Stern. You won't get the NFL. You won't get Major League Baseball.
The Major League Baseball is why I keep XM Radio around, A.
B. I would too.
Yeah, NFL and Howard Stern, I don't pay for anyway. I don't mind if he turns around and says, okay, for those people subscribing to NFL and Howard Stern, you've got to pay more. Okay, fine. I don't subscribe to that anyway. But if he's going to charge me more per radio, say it's $12.95 per month, $12.95 per month per radio. So if you have two radios, one for each car, then you're paying $25 at a time when Spotify is around, at a time when, you know, Rhapsody is around. You kind of have to wonder what he's thinking. Although
they should give a discount to a two-car family. That's a good point.
I agree.
If you're gonna have two cars and a Sirius radio in your house, they should say, hey, you know what? We want your business and we should be glad to have you there and not, you know, treat you like three new customers.
Right. Or say, hey, you know what? Yeah, we're going to raise it to $15, but guess what? We're going to throw in the internet stuff with it.
Yeah, at least, please.
As opposed to making it separate.
Well, this is what everybody warned about when they did the merger. They said, well, there'll be no constraining them and they'll be able to charge whatever they want. But they are competing with, like you say, Spotify and Pandora and all sorts of other devices. So, you know, even just putting your cell phone into your radio, if it doesn't work, it's going to hurt them in the profits.
Right. Right now, it's certainly not hurting them in the profits. They had net profits of $78 million in the last quarter, up 86% over the same period last year. And everything is up for them right now. They had they have 20.6 million subscribers, which makes them one of the most successful subscriber-based entertainment solutions in the country. And they plan on adding an additional 1.4 million customers in 2011.
Well, there you go. If they can keep adding customers at the rate they are, then they think, well, maybe we can charge them more.
You know, as a customer, I just have to gripe whenever anybody says we're going to charge you more and probably give you less.
But we'll give you more. We'll give you not one, but two emails.
Exactly. And speaking of griping, we should get to our listener email. The first one is from Aaron Rich, who, of course, has been a guest here on the program. And Michael, why don't you take that one?
Okay. Aaron says, hey, guys, I wanted to comment on the discussion of the Huffington Post from episode 100. I really think Karen was wrong and overstated the situation by saying that what Arianna Huffington doing is reprehensible and that her arrogance is unjustifiable. Please, there are a lot of reprehensible and unjustifiable things out there in the world, and this is not one of them. She's not killing people or clobbering baby seals. I also would warn listeners that, whether Karen knew it or not, the line about Arianna's so-called arrogance is a talking point from the Jonathan Tessini camp who are suing HuffPo. I would hope that Sandbox could be a bit less shrill in the future. I wanted to point you to two related stories from this week's episode of NPR's On the Media, their flagship media analysis and criticism show. First, there is an interesting evaluation of HuffPo by Tim Rudin, the LA Times media critic. And second, there's an interview with Tessini. I think it's important to point out that when pressed, Tessini basically can't say what is illegal about what HuffPo is doing because there isn't anything illegal about it, and just says that he doesn't like how arrogant Arianna Huffington is. That just sounds like sour grapes to me. He also makes a ridiculous comment that if Arianna had just decided from the beginning to give all the bloggers and writers a symbolic check for $25, this wouldn't be an issue. We all know that if she had done that, people would have called her greedy for not giving them more. And then he provides the two links to the stories he talks about, which we'll include in the show notes. And thanks for calling in, Aaron.
Or writing in this case. And, I realized halfway through your reading that as somebody who contributes to the Huffington Post, that maybe I should have read that one. But
too late.
Too late, yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, that was Karen's take. This is certainly a heated topic that a lot of people have an opinion on, the Huffington Post sale to AOL and whether the bloggers get paid.
Absolutely. So why don't you read the second email?
Absolutely. It's from Lloyd Goldschmied, who writes, Dear Michael and Sperling, I enjoyed your episode 100, but as for episode 101, dissing on the
Whoa.
Time Warner CEO for quote-unquote fundamental lack of knowledge of movies and piracy. Really? Really? If you want to hate the guy, at least listen to his words instead of trusting a paraphrased Hollywood Reporter excerpt. And he then provides a link to, I guess, the interview on Bloomberg.com. Buick said, quote, most of them have a three-week life in the theater, and then you can't find them anymore, and then they sit for something like 4 months, and then they show up at Walmart or VOD. During that period, you can't get it, no matter how much you're willing to pay. Piracy comes into that. Not that movies should be given the bums rush out of theaters, of course. It's a great Charlie Rose interview worth watching. Movies are most vulnerable to pirating when people are prevented from seeing them. Reducing windows reduces piracy. The most popular torrents come weeks after movies are released due to the low quality of the initial camcorder copies. Six of the top 10 most pirated movies, and he provides a link here to a Torrent Freak article which states the top 10 most pirated movies, are pirated from DVDs released or obtained from insiders, two from pay-per-view, one an early release R5 DVD, and only one was recorded in a theater. See also, and he has yet another link, Cheers Lloyd. So most of that was Lloyd, and he did throw in a little excerpt from Jeff Bukes, the head of Time Warner there.
I appreciate him writing in. I think I was not sure where I was, but I'm sorry I didn't actually see the interview with Charlie Rose. I didn't realize. I thought it was like a public speech and a Hollywood Reporter was, you know, reporting on it. I want to trust them as reporting what he said faithfully and accurately. What Lloyd describes is a little different than the impression I got from Jeff Bukes. So he has a good point to make. You always want to see the original interview in the original context of what was said. That said, this is the big issue that theaters say, if you make movies available on video on demand right away, then people won't go to the theater. That's why there is that gap between a movie in theaters and a movie coming out on video on demand. And if you make it available on video on demand, they won't go to the theaters at all, or they'll go much less, or movies won't have legs because people go, well, where's the video on demand? So that's the problem that we're talking about. It is a conundrum trying to balance the needs and desires of theaters, which is the driving engine of the entire movie business, and the need to not have a gap where there's going to be piracy. I don't think piracy is caused by that gap, though.
Piracy is caused by the availability of something at a price that can be given away very cheaply for free to people who don't want to pay. And that's really what we're talking about here.
Wait, that's true. I can't remember the last time I saw a movie pirated that was actually done by a guy sitting in a theater. Basically now all the copies you see are just pristine.
I know.
They're excellent. They look like DVDs.
Right. And so most of them are, you know, rips of DVDs that are then uploaded to BitTorrent.
But I think people are pirating them starting the opening weekend. I don't think it's people who would love to pay for movies on video on demand but are driven to piracy because the movie has left the theater but not come on DVD yet. And they're like, where can I get this movie? I'm so desperate. I guess I'll have to pirate it. No, I think it's people who don't want to pay and they start doing it opening weekend. They don't wait until it's out of theaters. It's not that one customer that would have gone to the theater but can't and is frustrated, and they can't get it on video on demand, so they're forced to turn to DVD.
Right, I mean, look at Game of Thrones. That was available on BitTorrent the day after it premiered on HBO here in the United States. And yet you could still subscribe to HBO and watch it the rest of the month. And did people do that? No, they went to BitTorrent and they downloaded it.
Well, you have to subscribe to HBO to do that, of course.
Right, exactly.
You're doing a BitTorrent free. But again, the Game of Thrones will come out on DVD probably about a month before the next season. So there's going to be a long gap where unless you subscribe to HBO, you can't access the series. Jeff Bukes, perhaps, or Lloyd, who might agree with him, would say, well, you're just being stupid. You're not letting them get the movie, so they're going to steal it. It's like, well, you want them to subscribe to HBO. Or similarly, you want them to go to the movie theater. The movie's playing in the theater. They're not, you know, the movies that leave a theater in 3 weeks are bombs that people don't want to see. And they tend to come out on DVD quicker. So they will come out in 3.5-4 months. So this gap for crappy movies that people reject at the box office is not what is driving piracy. What's driving piracy are people dying to see Thor.
Right, exactly. Well,
it's not the crappy movies that bomb. Obviously, people watch them too, but it's really the big popular movies where this happens.
Well, and you don't want to change consumer behavior to, well, I'll just wait three weeks and watch it on premium VOD.
Right. Even in the new context that I'm trusting Lloyd to have provided, I still don't really agree with Jeff Bukes, but his comment, what he was trying to say about when piracy occurs, I think Lloyd has definitely made clearer to us. I still disagree with it, however, but he's right. You should always watch the original interview whenever possible. Though Hollywood Reporter, frankly, is a source you should be able to depend on.
Right, and that is one of the hazards of depending on all of these media outlets for our news coverage. Right, well, exactly. I mean, we are distilling media coverage of the entertainment industry. And if the media coverage is not correct, then our distillation and analysis certainly won't be correct. In fact, on Deadline this week, there was a story about how basically Bukes had to defend all of the comments he made during the Charlie Rose interview. And they said he probably rused the day he agreed to sit down with Charlie Rose Rose for an interview because he spent much of the morning's quarterly conference call with Wall Street analysts explaining what many of his answers actually meant. So
that's why he should only come on Showbiz Sandbox.
Exactly. That's what I keep saying.
If he wants to reach us, how can he do it?
Well, you can reach us by emailing dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail, and we will get back to you. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. I would like to thank both Aaron Rich and Lloyd Goldschmied for emailing us. They were both two very well-written and thoughtful emails. You can find the email addresses or the voicemail number or ways to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or your RSS reader. You can find all those links on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at showbizsandbox.com, and you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael has a website. It's michaelgiltz.com. You can find me on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, when Michael and I will both be in the south of France covering the Cannes Film Festival, play nice.